Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
From Postcard from the Past and Wardour Studios, this is Podcast from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. This is a place where we dig deep into shoeboxes stored on top of wardrobes or under beds, in attics or cellars, to consider picture postcards and explore what it is that causes us to keep hold of these precious little cardboard rectangles. Each time I welcome two guests, and it's their postcards that act as small clues to direct us towards memories, mysteries and stories. I'm Tom Jackson. I'm delighted to say that today my guests are trombone player and tutor of improvised music, Sarah Gale Brand, and historian and writer Peter Mitchell. Peter and Sarah, welcome to Podcast from the Past.
Hello.
Hi.
Now, Sarah Gale Brand is a trombonist working in free jazz, improvised music, and she's been working in that kind of music since the 1990s. She's played alongside a catalogue of other great musicians, and you may even have seen her performing alongside TV's Stuart Lee or heard her presenting jazz on Radio 3. She's also an academic and has an academic life, which gained her a PhD in improvised music, and she's a professor of improvisation at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And Sarah's latest release, out now, is All Will Be Said, All To Do Again, on the Regardless label. And Sarah joins us today bearing a rather blurry, rather unspecific London postmark. Why so blurry?
Well, I was born in London, in South Woodford, and I think the hospital I was born in is no longer there. I don't know if that's connected to me.
That's the first blur.
Well, yeah, it could be because, you know, that kind of terrifying act can never happen again. Or it was just, you know, knocked down. But so I was born in a building that now no longer exists. And then I was brought up in Birmingham after Mum and Dad broke up. And I was in Birmingham from the age of about 4 to the age of 22.
Oh, so most of your growing up was done there, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, fetching up, let's say, not about growing up. And then I went to university finally when I was 22, and I went to Middlesex University, and I basically stayed down in the southeast. I was in London from 93 until 2006, 2005, when I moved out to Kent. But I've been, you know, I'm backwards and forwards to London most of the time, so it doesn't feel like I've ever left London. I just can't afford to live there. I've been all over London, and there's never been one place in London that I've ever felt particularly at home with or ever felt particularly not at home in. And I feel umbilically attached to London. So when I've contemplated moving away from the southeast or sort of further than 20 miles from London, I start to break out in a rash. And I sort of don't actually like London that much, but I also don't hate it.
I don't think that's so unusual, though, is it, to be attached to a city and have very mixed feelings?
Yeah, and I feel kind of proud of London in the sense that I'm proud that I've managed to survive here doing the sort of the work that I do. as in it's none of what I do is particularly, you know, well paid, and I'm not a millionaire, as you can probably imagine. But I'm really glad I've survived. I think you survive London, actually. Mm. I think you survive it. I think it's kind of a
steely way of looking at it, isn't it?
It is, and it's a place where there's so much wealth and so much deprivation, yes, and so much inequality, and it's the place where really, really dreadful people make terrible decisions about the rest of the country, and I can't quite believe that that's all concentrated in like a square mile of that city. It's kind of, yes, really
and you,
odd.
You can go along and look at the buildings in which they're making those decisions.
Well, you see, it's convenient because I'm only 20 minutes away from London. I can nip into town, bit of protest, back in time to pick the dogs up from the dog crash, you know. So it all works really rather well for my middle-class guilt.
Very good. That's the urban experience.
That's what it is. It is indeed, yes.
Now, Sarah, do you still send postcards?
I do, to my mum when I go away from home. I still send her a postcard. I've still got a couple, which makes me feel a bit concerned that I never sent them to her. When I was looking for postcards, I found a couple that said, "Hi, Mum, having a great time." And I thought, well, how come I've got this? Ah. And so she might have just sort of like slipped them back into my bag when I wasn't looking, visiting her.
They been posted, do you think? Did they have postmarks
on? They had the postmark on, so I don't understand. Yeah, it's really odd. But and the lovely thing is she's got a wall in her spare bedroom where she pins all these postcards up, and I didn't know about it. So she had a wall full of postcards from places I've been. And particularly when I was gigging in Europe, which, you know, and around the world, which I'm not allowed to do anymore. And I'd always send her a postcard. So I do actually, and I buy postcards for myself to put on the fridge door or just as a way of remembering a place. I do have an affinity to postcards. It might just be my age, my generation, but I still think that they are, you know, even if I'm not going to send them, I'll hold on to them as I was there. You know, I went there. You know,
tangible little badges of honour. You've made it.
Yeah, kind of. And also just as a thing to kind of take away. Holidays are very ephemeral, aren't they? Kind of whisk away. But a postcard is, I was here, I was there, and I was doing that there, you know. So I like them for that sort of tangible reason.
Very good. Well, we'll see some of your postcards in a minute. Mm-hmm. Now, Peter Mitchell is a historian who spent time researching the records, by which I mean archives, not LPs, of the East India Company and India Office. He's currently an oral historian on a project called Voices of COVID-19. But it's his latest book that has gained a lot of attention, Imperial Nostalgia, subtitled How the British Conquered Themselves. So the sort of ultimate imperial self-own, as they say nowadays. It's a razor-sharp analysis of the myths and fantasies that drive politics in Britain to this day, especially the most frightening and seductive spectre of them all, the ghost of the British Empire. Peter comes to us today with, again, it's another, these postmarks are rather blurry today, NE4, but blurred. Well, what's that NE4 postmark mean?
It is quite nebulous, but NE4 is basically the west end of Newcastle,
right?
Which for me begins at about the Lytton Phil at the bottom of the Westgate Road, goes past the portico of the Central Station, up the Westgate Road, past the Tyne Opera House, past the casino, and then up towards Arthur's Hill on a long straight line, which is actually built atop Hadrian's Wall. And why do I like it? I suspect.
Why can't you escape it?
Well, yeah, I suspect that for reasons I can't completely work out for myself, it will probably be the last thing I think about before I die or something. It's like we said before, it's probably written on the inside of my skull, but I'd rather not find out. I remember like hating where I was from. I'm from the east end of Newcastle, but that doesn't matter. I remember hating it and wanting to leave and never wanting to come back. And then I dropped out of university when I was about 21, like, because I was really depressed and sad and a bit of a mess. And I came home and I used to go and visit my mate who lived on Arthur's Hill at the top of the big hill at the Westgate Road. And I'd walk from the middle of town up to his house, which took about half an hour. And I spent all winter doing that in the snow and the rain. And it was, and I suddenly thought, holy God, this city is, this city is impossibly romantic.
Oh.
It's a really dense, rich landscape of absolute glamour and sexiness, which it is. It's an astonishing place that I happen to be sort of connected to by birth.
So that sounds like you had a sort of complete transformation of your opinion there. What did something prompt that, or was it just a switch turned, or?
I think antidepressants help, to be honest.
Okay.
But
that would make sense.
Something turned, and suddenly I thought, actually, this is one of the most interesting places on earth to me. Like, I had that kind of, you know, when you get that sense of like of the glamour of where you're from, even though it's kind of unrecapturable, even though what you're looking at isn't necessarily the place that you inhabit, but places it's been before, and you get a sense of its kind of textured histories and things.
Oh, well, maybe you're describing what it is to have the excitement of a historian as well, that sense that you can, you sort of see the layers within a place.
I guess, yeah. I mean, I'm not really a historian, I'm just a pretend historian, but... But yeah, the Westgate Road is good. Also, it used to smell of warm milk on Weetabix, because that's where the Scottish and Newcastle brewery was. And that smelled great to walk past in winter.
Yeah. So do breweries consistently smell nice, or do they smell horrible sometimes?
They smell malty.
Malty, right, okay. So it's a sort of shreddies thing going on.
Yeah, exactly. Shreddies. That's exactly what it is. Shreddies, but... More boozy. Shreddies with a bit of pub carpet.
Excellent. Oh. Now, Peter, when did you last send a postcard?
Probably quite a while ago. I'm really good at buying postcards and I'm really terrible at sending them.
Okay, well, that's half the battle, definitely.
Well, yeah, plus I don't want to give them away. I want them for myself.
Oh, really? Really? So you have a little collection or just a stash? Or?
Well, I tend to have like quite a lot pinned up above my desk at any one time. But of them are ones I'll have bought myself, because I just don't think... I'm 39. I don't think a lot of people...
You poor old soul.
I know, right? But I don't think... But what I'm saying here is that I'm actually really youthful, and I don't think a lot of people of my idle millennial generation actually send postcards to each other.
Right, right. Well, that's why we've really put you at the lower end of the people we invite on this podcast, I'm afraid.
So I'm just
very good. Look, we're going to hear more about your postcards in a minute. Before we do see and hear about the cards that you and Sarah brought along, a quick one of mine. So this is in the postcard from the past style, like I do on Twitter and in my book. So it's an old card, and we'll have a look at the message on it. So this card, I should say to everyone at home, normally we'd be in a studio, we'd be, you know, knocking our cups of coffee together jollily and looking at these cards over each other's shoulders. But because we're all remote today, as you can probably hear... I've sent out a sort of dope sheet, a kind of crib sheet to everyone, so we can all see all the cards, even though they're not in front of us. So the card we're looking at first is a place called, is it Ilham Rock, Dovedale, Derbyshire, 1988. So, you know, very much in the modern era. And it says, this is sent to someone in Braintree in Essex, and it's from someone called Kirsty. And she's a teenager, young teenager. And she says, Anne, I'm having a great time. I only got here this morning. They've got a TV here, so I'll be able to watch Neighbours. And I guess, or 1988, was this the sort of high watermark of Neighbours being an absolute cultural necessity?
Well, it depends. Yeah, kind of. It was the excuse to not do your A-level revision, because I was 18 then. And, it was kind of, you know, and it would come on.
Post-Kylie or pre-Kylie?
Oh, Kylie.
How is it?
It was very, very much Kylie in that, that
original
point.
Kylie.
It was Kylie and Jason and Mrs. Mangle. Was it Mrs. Mangle?
Yeah, Mrs. Mangle.
And Harold, and I don't know. I'm. You see, this is terrible, because I've maintained my mystique and aura by telling everyone I was a feat and intellect at the age of 18, but I wasn't.
In fact, I was watching Bounce of the Dog.
I was watching bloody Neighbours and, you know, listening to Radio 1 with Gary Davies.
I had a poster of Carrie and Jason on my wall of my bedroom. I was six in 1988, but my sister was well into them, so I was too. And Kylie was wearing this incredible, chunky, lovely, chunky knit sweater, and she had that big perm.
Yes. Yes.
It was a big thing, those jumpers that Kylie wore. She doesn't wear jumpers anymore.
I bet she does.
I'm sure she does. When it's chilly, I mean, she's only very slim. She must catch the cold.
And I don't know if she still lives in Australia. I mean, maybe they don't need jumpers in Australia.
I think she lives here most of the time, doesn't she?
Does she?
I think she's ascended to a different level of existence where you don't have to live anywhere. But she lives in our souls. The thing is, we laughed at this stuff for years, and I would absolutely wear those jumpers now.
Really?
Like, yeah, in a heartbeat.
Would you have the perm, though, Peter? Would you have the perm?
Well, I'm bald, so let's say, yeah, why not?
You'd wear it. Yeah. You could have it temporarily.
If you had the choice.
Well, that, does it mean I get to have hair again? Yeah, maybe.
After Kirsty has finished with Neighbours, she goes on. Just, I mean, it's all downhill from there, really. Watching Neighbours was the highlight of her trip. But she says, tomorrow, I think we're going to a museum tomorrow. So she's got a bit confused about that. But actually, by saying tomorrow twice in the same sentence, she's had the opportunity to correct her spelling of the word tomorrow on the second version, having got it wrong on the first one. So maybe that's a good strategy for correcting your spelling. And she says, I'll send you another postcard on Wednesday. See you soon. Love, L-U-V, Kirsty. So I think she sounds like she was having a pretty good time, actually.
I love Kirsty, and I hope she's flourishing.
Well, yes. I mean, she's probably...
I don't know if she was a teenager. She could be Attorney General with just very bad spelling, or you know, she's probably 60, you know, and just on the loose. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, mind you, though,
I could read out the whole address, and we could be a lot closer to finding that out. But I'm not going to.
Yeah, come on, let's get Kirsty. Come on, guys. But I'm just that look. I love Derbyshire, and that looks beautiful. I suppose
the bit that made me chuckle really is that you're right. You've got the most amazing natural landscape there with these outcrops of rocks, and actually very nicely shot on this postcard, very much saying go to the outdoors. And of course, Kirsty really wants to sit at home and watch Neighbours. That, I think that's the sort of tension that pulled at me. But,
okay, but, I'm Kirsty. It was me. I'm Kirsty. God's sake.
When did you change your name?
This witch hunt must be over.
What a hell of a coincidence. Anyway, look, I should let you know at home, the images of all these cards are going to be on the website, postcardfromthepast.co.uk, so you can see that lovely view of the Tor in Dovedale, and you can consider whether you would have gone for a walk there or whether you'd gone in and watched Neighbours. Now... Peter and Sarah, you've been kind enough to do a bit of homework. You've dug out some cards for us for this recording. Let's start with you, Sarah. What's the first card you've got for us? This seems to be a sort of exercise in typography.
It's postcard size, and it's lived on my refrigerator door since I was sent it, really. It came as part of, I got it quite a while ago, it came as part of a package with some CDs inside that I was on. And the sender of the card, and in fact the band leader of the CDs that I was on, was a blues guitarist called Billy Jenkins. He's a jazz musician as well, and Billy's sort of he's sort of semi-retired now. I think he might be, I'm not sure, but I was in his band for a few tours and on a few of his albums, and he's one of the funniest men I know, and he was absolutely brilliant, still is a brilliant musician. And on the stage he was really funny, and he used to do my favourite tune I ever played of his was called They Built a Ring Road Through My Garden. And he do things like, you know, we did an album called Sounds Like Bromley and that sort of thing. Okay. And he's very much into the idea that...
He's a British musician.
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry, yeah. He's into Crown Green Bowling as well. Met his wife there. And how can I describe Bill? He's basically of the view that religion, you know, the religion is music, you know,
right.
And music is religion. And he had an ensemble called, we always used to tour as the Voice of God Collective.
Right.
And I was by no means an original member of this ensemble. I was thrilled to be asked to join him when he came. I used to see him play when I was a music student. 1,004 years ago, and he used to go to the Vortex, which is a jazz club in northeast London, and he'd be on, and I would just be in complete and utter captivated awe of him and his brilliant musicianship and his wit and his fantastic, you know, music that he'd written. And then he came to our college to do a workshop, and from there he then asked me to be in his band not long after I left college, and I couldn't believe it. And I met some really great friends in his group, and we did some just amazing gigs, and I had some really, really great times. So anyway, we did this album, and that he sent that postcard with it.
So for people who can't be bothered to go and look on the blog, we should describe the card.
Yeah. Shall I read out the words?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, it's sort of kind of in the form of the Lord's Prayer, but it's been changed to the blues prayer, basically. So it's our bluesman, which art in blues heaven. Blues be thy name, thy blues and come. Thy blues be done in blues earth as it is in blues heaven. Give us this day our daily blues, and forget us our three passing chords, as we forgive those who pass three chords against us. And lead us not into the temptations, but deliver us from Craptville, for thine is the bluesdom, the blues power and the blues glory, for ever and ever. Oh, yeah.
Very good.
On the other side of the card, he's just written, oh, yeah, to me in his handwriting, in a big kiss.
That's a good message for any card, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just that's all it is. And he's very economic with words, Bill, when he wrote to you. He would normally, he was one of the last musicians that actually would call you up to do something, which I really miss. Getting a phone call from someone and saying, hey, do you want to do a tour?
Right.
Hey, do you want to do an album? Just kind of like an email coming through now. It sort of feels a bit sort of perfunctory and, you know, whereas getting a phone call from someone who says, I want you to come and do some gigs with me is just really quite romantic almost, you know, it's lovely. And the thing that Bill used to do is he used to get the audience to shout, oh yeah, at certain points. So there's sort of audience interaction.
So this is really part of it.
And you know, just kind of the whole sort of Billy Jenkins experience is to be pulled into part of this sort of belief system, which is a gig, you know. His father was a bishop, I think, so he's kind of got that. It's kind of faith based, but not about Christianity. You see what I mean? But the irony, of course, being that blues is from a faith based music, you know. And so it's all encompassing. You feel part of something when you're on stage with Billy. But it's very Zappa-like, you know. In the middle, he'll stick his hand up with a sign, and you know that's a sign to go to another part of the music. Or suddenly, he'll just sort of stop the music and do sort of hand signals, and you have to do something along with each hand signal. So you can't ever really get bored on stage because you're constantly waiting to see what's going to happen next, which is brilliant.
Well, that sounds like the kind of environment that you would thrive in.
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. And as I say, it was one of the biggest shocks of my young musician's life when I got the call saying, would you come and be in my band? Because I couldn't believe that, you know, because we were all huge fans of his when we were at college, and all our lecturers worked with him.
Right.
So for me to get asked to go and join his band with some people who taught me was just kind of, you know, you can imagine when you're in your 20s, that's just kind of, you know, you can't believe it.
Well, what do you think about this idea of music then having a sort of religious spiritual effect, if you sort of push it far enough, and you if you find the right space in the music? I mean, I think I'm always looking for a kind of transcendence when I listen to music. Is that just me fantasizing about wanting to go to a higher plane, or can music do that?
I think so. I mean, I do nothing but music. As a music therapist, I spend my time helping people with music.
So that works.
Using music as a communication rather than words, because, you know, in a psychotherapeutic way. And as a lecturer, you have the sense of, you know, sort of passing on, you know, information. Well, it's not just information. You're sort of Socratically passing on information, if you like, and getting people to buy into and the concepts that you're talking about and hoping they understand. So there's a sort of There's parallels, I think, with people taking your word on trust and belief. You know, so the dialogue and the language between musicians is very much based on communication and relationship, which is all a group. It's a congregating music, isn't it? You know, every music, even if it's a soloist, requires a congregation of people listening or playing with you in order for it to work. You know, it's just a fantastic socialising.
Creating moments, a moment
exactly.
Where something
and
can happen.
That you share them together without necessarily needing words. Now, I'm not at all religious, but I do feel that if I had to commit to a belief system, it would be music and music making. And it just consumes your life. Music isn't tangible until it's played. I mean, even yes. A piece of music written down is meaningless until it's lifted off the page. And there's a certain element of mystery and intangibility about religion as well, possibly.
Yes.
But the experience of music, I've been to see a Mahler symphony and just been in tears afterwards, or I've listened to some Charles Mingus in the car and just had to pull over because I just love it so much, you know. So yes. I have moments of personal connection with music that I can't explain.
Yes.
You know? So I think that's very religious as well, spiritual.
Well, yeah, no, I'm inclined to agree. Well, thank you for opening that door with your blues prayer. And I'm happy that was on the fridge as well. That can only be a sign of love.
Yeah, I suppose so. I am the sort of person that just opens the fridge door and stares into my fridge sometimes, hoping something will appear. So I do see it often, you know.
I'm sure there was some cheese in here 3 weeks ago.
And it's still there. Look at it.
Well, yeah. Very good. Now, Peter, let's move on to the first of your cards. And now I think we've got a black and white picture here. Tell me why, what this is and why you've got it.
This is a bit indulgent and a little bit too serious, maybe. But
not at all.
This is...
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah, let's find out. So this is one of a series of photographs made by a photographer called Keith Patterson with the Amber Collective in Newcastle upon Tyne. And he basically hung around in Easington in County Durham during the miners' strike and documented everyday life and what was happening there. And Easington, like, there was loads of clashes in Easington. It's where Billy Elliot was set and filmed, right. et cetera. So I think people should be very cautious of the kind of aestheticization of past labour struggles, like, oh, look at it, isn't it gritty and 80s, it's so retro. And, you know, it becomes a kind of like, I love the radicalism of the miners' strike, but not the radicalism of now. That's threatening and weird.
Like dead socialists, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's like the whole Jeremy Deller thing of reenacting Orgreave and making it kind of fun. So on the back of this, I didn't send you a picture of the back. It says, "Congratulations on your A-level results, Pete. Lots of love, man."
Uh-huh. Gosh, you've had this a while.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, it was a while ago. So basically, I mean, this is where it gets indulgent and over serious is like, I was a really bad, school student. I was really unmotivated. Didn't know what to do with myself. I really wasn't doing well, etc. And then when I did do well in my A-levels, which took everyone by surprise, I hadn't applied to university or anything. My mum wasn't in when I came home, but I just found this on the kitchen table. I mean, we're not a very demonstrative family, but what I loved about it, and the reason I've kept it and had it above my desk in various houses for years, is that, like, you know, like, I don't know how much of this was intentional, but I know that my mum kind of grew up slightly in with the kind of family mythology of her granddad, who she loved, who was a miner from a really young age and educated himself and did that whole very sentimentalizable kind of like story of working class autodidacticism. He ended up head of the Miners' Federation of Great Britain and a Labour MP and stuff. But the thing is, I think what I suspected she was trying to remind me of, consciously or not, is the idea that you don't have to be bored and stuff's at stake and education is liberatory and culture's liberatory and it's to be taken and it has to be taken by force because certain people won't let you have it. And that education is part of a struggle and a liberation. And and not to give up or get lazy. If that makes sense.
No, I think I can see that
because,
in there.
Yeah. Just because we got middle class and directionless and liberal, like, was no reason to stop taking stuff from people who think they own it, basically. So yeah, I mean, I keep this above my desk when I can.
But it's a very specific choice for a congratulations. I presume did she go and buy it specially? I mean, it's not kittens and well done, is it? This is a choice made.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, also, I mean, my mum would spew at the thought of a kittens and well done card, but she's quite a hard lady, and she was a primary school teacher herself,
okay.
So she's very serious about education. I don't know, like I just think it's cool.
Yeah, I think it's cool. Even if you strip everything away from it, it's very nice to have a little card that says well done, because that stays with you. You can look at it now and remember the emotions from then.
Actually, a bit. I was really ashamed of myself as a student, and then I was really chuffed that my mum was actually proud of me. So,
were you surprised at your results then when you did really well suddenly?
Yeah, of course. I've been pretty useless, and I was didn't know whether I wanted to go to university or whatever, and you know, it was a bit of a woo university, but yeah. So,
because it's a strange thing, isn't it? Because you haven't changed. You did the exams as one person, and you got the results as the same person. But there's something odd about the way when you get good results unexpectedly, and the same with bad results unexpectedly, suddenly you are a different... Your outlook is different on the world, because your options are either opening or closing.
Yeah, your relationship to the world kind of shifts a little bit.
Yeah, well, in your case, happily then, because you did have some more options there, you know.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, I mean, I've just published my first book, and it has the same like kind of like, oh, you have a slightly different relationship to the world now, because obviously, you know, you're rich and everyone wants to be your friend or sleep with you.
Exactly.
I mean, it's been a whirlwind the past couple of weeks.
Are you joking? Or do you mean it has been?
No, I'm joking.
No. But I'm sure you've had a lot of media attention with your book.
I'm living maybe not a whirlwind. I'm living at home in my childhood bedroom, and there's a pandemic on. Yeah, no, but yeah.
The world is in a whirlwind right now.
A bit like, I'm sure, Sarah, like when you're performing on stage and when you've been in that position, like your relationship to the world changes, doesn't it? Like it's a slightly a different way of inhabiting your body.
This has been several times when I have really had to drag my heaving carcass out of my house. And get to a gig, because I've felt, and it's been the last thing that I felt like I've wanted to do, and I just I can't bear it. And then I've done the gig and I've come home transformed. And it sounds like a cliche, it really is, but it's a cliche because it's so true. You are transformed, and things might not have improved for you emotionally, but you've had a time where you've been preoccupied enough to do something else. And again, it's the communal idea of being with other people and forgetting yourself for a while.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about your book a bit, Peter, because I very much enjoyed it, and it's there were bits of it that I would have wanted to pick up and talk about, but I feel if I paraphrased particularly some of your analysis of contemporary politicians, I would do it so clumsily I'd end up being sued for libel. But you've done it with, I mean, it's not a hit job, but you analyse some of the sort of the way some current politicians present themselves and the myths that they draw on with a very, very sharp pen.
Well, I think we did have lawyers look at it, to be honest.
Did you?
So some people are very litigious. I mean...
But you can't sue anyone for a myth, the myths that you're uncovering, the ghosts that hover above some of these sort of narratives that people create around themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, I think, you know, it's not that, you know, doing a kind of culture wars book where you're like, look at this dude, what an idiot, what a bastard, etc. is useless. But I kind of want to take the focus off individuals as individuals and more like say, it's not, I don't care what this person thinks. I don't care what the state of their soul is. That's for the theologians. Like, what I'm interested in is how a public figure activates myths and imaginaries. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, how do you how do you, you know, like, it's not like, is Rory Stewart kind of putting it on? It's like, that's kind of a meaningless question. It's like,
yes.
Why is Rory Stewart so popular? Why do people just have to keep reproducing those pictures of him dressed in a shalwar kameez and stuff? Like, why is it so fascinating?
It's that thing of, you know, people say if they didn't exist, you'd have to invent them. But it kind of doesn't matter. Yeah. Matter whether you've had to invent them or not. They do exist.
Yeah.
But the Rory Stewart bits I found particularly insightful, just because I think so much has been written and considered about our current Prime Minister, that it's even entered the public consciousness, some of the strange devices that sort of surround him and these strange kind of role play that goes on. But Stewart kind of, I'm not sure his bubble has been particularly burst, but when you tie it in with the sort of whole John Buchan thing, it just, to me, it seems so bloody obvious. Why didn't I notice that before, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, his bubble clearly hasn't burst, because I've just got my new Statesman through the door, opened it up, and there's a like 5-page interview with him that says, like, could he have been a great pandemic PM? where did you get that from? Literally, because the guy just rocks up wearing like a borrowed turban and starts talking about Alexander the Great. Oh, God, he could have been Prime Minister, you know. He could have really got us out of this hole.
We needed more walking. That's what we needed.
Yeah, we needed him to come kip with loads of people, but in a COVID-safe way. Like, I don't know. I don't have anything against Rory Stewart. I'm sure he's a wonderful chap. I just think, you know, he also doesn't meaningfully exist except as a collection of quotations.
That's a very good way of putting it. And, of course, the other big area that you put into the subtitle of your book, this whole area of nostalgia. I mean, I'm very, very wary of nostalgia, because I sort of do all this stuff with old postcards, and it's very tempting, I think, and some people slightly misunderstand what I'm doing and think that I'm wallowing in old stuff and cooing over it to some extent, I think I'm more of a sort of irresponsible archivist in that I'm spending my time going through. I'm not a historian. I'm not telling a historical story, but I am trying to point up the weird emotional and factual unexpected stuff that went on in the past. So, you know, people are, you get postcards aren't full of people saying, "Ooh, it's lovely." They're saying, you know, I've got an ache in my leg, or Terry fell in the swimming pool, or this sort of stuff I really hate it here.
That's amazing. I mean, that's what's brilliant about the Twitter feed, isn't it? It's like, because these things are kind of, because they're decontextualized, kind of almost artificially, like you don't try to find out who it was, and then you take one phrase and like, it's a way of saying, here's an actual kind of like immediacy of experience.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. It should feel like the person's talking to you. That's kind of trying to do. But enough about me, because
I think we should all be a responsible archivist. I think that's a really cool phrase.
But you need your footnotes. You need to do it properly. That's the problem.
I sometimes find it quite alarming what people do write on postcards, particularly if they're sort of on holiday. I don't know if I'd ever write. Even if I was having a dreadful time, I don't think I'd write to people I love to say, I'm having a really bad time. You know, because I suppose they'd think, oh no, you know, I mean, I'd wait till I got home and bitched about it then, but you know, or I just wouldn't send a card. It's just, I'm sometimes amazed at people's sort of candor.
Yeah. I think sometimes people's ability to whinge kind of outweighs their good manners. Sometimes they've got that really annoying thing of they're sort of showing off. They're saying, and I told them it was awful. You know, recounting a battle that they won, but off. To be honest,
you've had postcards from my mother, haven't you?
and I thank you for them. But no, sometimes see, I'm lucky because I can see the handwriting, and quite often it's a teenage girl who's whinging or complaining and being funny. The thing is, not all these cards are actually written in a serious tone. So there's something about typing them out on the Twitter. They appear to have a consistent tone in terms of the way they're written. But you can tell people are actually joking, because people did used to joke in the old days too. And it's very hard to imagine that. We always imagine we're the super ironic, clever ones now. And social media seems to create this, this thing, because everyone has a snappy comment to come back with in a kind of very strange way, you forget that people made jokes in the old days too. Mm. You know, they were mucking about.
But I mean, this is the thing about nostalgia as well, is we imagine that only ourselves are kind of self-aware.
Yes.
And that, like, everyone else lived in history. They lived in days of yore. And back then they were like, yore is very nice and has no kind of temporality. We just live in it, you know? Yore's great.
Well, I think this is one of the great things about your book is you talk about the idea that this idea, well, you sort of spend quite a lot of time talking about how nostalgia works. And this idea of a sort of yearning for the empire and yearning for the war, and how it's a kind of hall of mirrors or a mise en abîme, or there's a sort of people can be nostalgic in the past for even further back in the past. So tell me a bit about how nostalgia works. That you
thing is that it's one of those concepts that closer you look at it, the bigger it gets, and the less easy it is to pin down. But I mean, in short, like the way I look at it in the book is a sense that, you know, the present and the experience of history as you live it is traumatic and terrifying, and always has been, to different degrees, but it always has been. And to imagine stable pasts, to imagine pasts that you can aestheticize and bound and kind of have as a kind of, as a whole separate imaginary, it's like we have this idea about Tudor England. Oh, it's this kind of dance and the guy's wearing these hats, you know? And, you know, there's Mark Rylance with his eyebrows. Like, here's the world you would have lived in. And the idea is, because we know the rules of that world, you kind of imagine ourselves being in that world, also knowing the rules, forgetting that everyone who actually lived in that world didn't know the rules.
He didn't.
It wasn't a world to them. It was an unfolding chaos, just like our own present. I mean, they lived in Tudor England. They didn't live in Wolf Hall, and that's a really hard thing to remember about the past. I mean, that's why I'm really wary of looking at this Keith Patterson photo and thinking, oh yes, the miners' strike. You know, because that kind of folds into a kind of nostalgism that does no favours to the people who actually had to endure those times. And it becomes politically quietistic and gives you nothing that you can use. You end up like, it's like that Ken Loach Spirit of 45 film. It's like, I kind of want to fight this election, not one from 70 years ago.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's why I hate watched Downton Abbey.
I can't even watch it.
That's an icon of this conversation, really, isn't it?
And it's just that sort of thing. I can't stand the rose-tinted glasses, which is the whole Downton Abbey thing. And it kind of gives this idea that the British have always been decent, you know.
Yeah.
And the upper classes are thoroughly decent people who would never dream of hurting the lower orders, you know. And I think that's why we're in this situation now. I do. I think a lot of it, people believe it. They want to believe it, you know.
I mean, there's a kind of like, Downton Abbey is, you know, it's about a class that has always imagined itself to be existing in a fallen present and on the decline. You know, it's always the climb. It's always bride's head, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like since aristocrats, since the Norman conquest, since the first of this guy sitting in his castle, he's been like, the aristocracy has sadly decayed, the old ways are changing, and the First World War will sweep all of these old certainties away.
It's so boring. Absolutely. It is. Everything is tinged with, you know, Nimrod playing in the background.
But isn't this really sort of an expression of the fact that the those in power, the aristocracy in power, and to some extent we still have the aristocracy in power,
We do, definitely.
They're very aware that their position is extraordinarily precarious. And programmes like this and stories like this are really just a sort of wail. If only my position of absolute power was less precarious. It's so unfair. Isn't that what they're all saying?
It's such a potent fantasy, isn't it? You get to reenact your sense of insecurity now as a kind of this kind of elegiac kind of like, ouh, this kind of lovely, the kind of jouissance of, oh no, the servants are revolting, but it's in old style costumes.
But they don't revolt though, do they? They give their lives They're very live to the people who live in the big rooms upstairs.
Do you know what?
That's the true bit.
I got one episode in and I'm just not. I probably should have written a chapter on it. I probably should have done my homework, but I just couldn't be arsed. I'm sorry.
It might have been when I was avoiding writing my PhD thesis.
Oh, that does the job.
On the same lines as Neighbours and my A-level. So I think we did. I'm really seeing a pattern here, which is probably I should call my psychotherapist now, actually.
I think we're in danger of wallowing in not wallowing in nostalgia now. So I'll get out. No more wallowing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Podcasts from the Past, the Postcard Podcast. And my guests today are musicians Sarah Gellbrand and historian Peter Mitchell. Now, here's a surprise. We've received a postcard. It's a postcard of Chesterfield Cathedral. Is it a cathedral? I think it is. With the famous crooked spire. Here set against an impossibly blue sky and a DER van in the foreground. Is that a television company? Television Rentals, I think. Could be wrong. Anyway, this was sent by Mrs. Howson of Chesterfield, Derbyshire, and she says, the answer to the quiz is Sean Connery. I'm sorry, Mrs. Howson, that's the wrong answer. Now, on to the postcard stories. Sarah, what's the second card you've got for us?
So, what did I say? Oh, yeah. Greetings from Warrington. This is another a threefer.
Oh, yes. Very nice.
Greetings from Warrington. And it's a picture of people looking a bit sort of, you know, nonplussed and bored in a shopping centre. Some kind of odd, weird angle of a sculpture, which might be a fountain, I don't know. It's like a Mad Hatter, maybe.
It's a teapot.
I always thought that was Margaret Thatcher on a really bad day.
This is one of the worst set of photographs I've ever seen.
Yeah, and then there's the Royal Spectacular something today.
Spectacular.
Just a bridal. Oh, I haven't got my glasses on. Bridal Spectacular. And people presumably going into a bridal fair and just sort of some woman sitting on next to a fountain looking a bit bored. And on the other side is the words, Happy Birthday, Gaily. Mark Cross, Mark Kiss, and Gailey's the nickname from my best friend. I'll go into that in a minute. The postcard actually is from Golden Square, the old fish market, and the shopping mall, and the Mad Hatter's tea party, and all from Warrington. And my best friend is drummer Mark Sanders, and he and I have been working together for longer than either of us are prepared to discuss. And we've got this thing about postcards from really ordinary places that have no business making postcards of themselves. And so this is one in a collection that he's got. And he sent this to me for a birthday card. And we so
he curated this specially.
Yes. This he
good work.
He would have gone to Warrington for some reason at one point and found the most boring, matter of fact, nothing card about of a shopping mall. I'm sure Warrington's got more to say for itself than this, but
yeah,
it's one
imagine.
Of the most
yeah.
boring postcards I've ever seen. And so this is emblematic of my friendship with Mark, basically. If either of us are any part of the world and we find a piece of tat or sort of an awful little piece of this little tiny trinket or something you'd put on your mantelpiece, we'll buy it and send it to each other, and we just. Less so these days, but we've spent a long time filling each other's homes with utter crap, either postcards or objects and photographs of the mullet hairstyle, which sounds everyone's joking about that now, but they weren't back in the mid-90s when we were touring. And
I'd have thought in Neighbours there were a few.
There were, but nobody was laughing about it then. But now everyone laughs at the mullet. But back when the mullet was a thing, there were only a few of us that were going, "Christ, that's a really terrible, awful."
Oh, so
way
you
to
were
look.
You were an early mocker? Is that what you're saying?
I was an early mocker adopter, as it were, or adopter mocker of the mullet. Awful, awful hairstyle. There's no.
So this is a sort of an exercise in ironizing. Aspects of popular culture that you're indulging
not in. not even irony. No, it's nowhere near as sophisticated as irony. It's just look at that. Christ, that's awful. And that's it, and just enjoying. I mean, we had this thing, we were in Amsterdam gigging, Mark and I, and we came across a shop in Amsterdam called Banana Night Shop.
Right.
And we couldn't work out what it was selling
because
it was closed. We didn't know what Banana Night Shop meant, and we kept going back to find, and it would always be closed. And probably because they didn't have anything to sell because they were called Banana Night Shop or the other way around. He and I used to live not far from each other in Stoke Newington in North London, and there was a chemist there called Graham Chemist. Not Graham's Chemist, but Graham Chemist. And we would always think, why Graham Chemist? So that he and I would spend a lot of time pointing at things, going, why? And that's terrible. And it's nothing to do with snobbery. It might sound like snobbery because I'm from Birmingham and he's from Bromley originally.
I think it's okay to be wide-eyed at the strangeness of the world. I think that's
it's just the
normal.
Kind of what were they thinking sort of thing. So it's not about saying I love the mullet.
Yeah.
Ironically, it's about saying, oh my God, and when you travel a lot, when you go to different places as a musician, you experience a lot of that. What the. And it's not necessarily in other countries. It's right here in the UK, right on our doorstep.
Have you ever released a track called Banana Night Shop?
No, but I ought to now.
Yeah.
No.
An album, but...
No, I have got... I've got a little list of album titles in my phone, on the notes pages of things that I'm going to call things one day. But Banana Night Shop, no. And there's just something...
It's got a rhythm to it.
Banana Night Shop, possibly. I don't know. It's too special. It's too special for the world to
hold it close to your heart.
Well, once you put an album out, I'm sure Peter feels this way about it, a book. Once something's named and released, it's not yours anymore. It's out into the world, and
yes.
You're not responsible for how it's received, and you're certainly not responsible for what it does. And so you kind of once it's out there, and I kind of want to keep. I'm one of these people that has a cat that will never go out. I don't want that. That's why I've got dogs, so they'll never be outdoors without me. I don't want anything that precious to be out in the world defenceless.
Some things are just too special, like mullets. Like,
they are, And I think this is something about myself and my best mate as well. There are certain things that only he and I will really, really find funny or weird or odd. No one else will see it. And I think that, for me, is the mark of friendship, and we've seen each other through some very weird times personally in each other's lives. And we've always managed to hold on to this strain of kind of question mark about stuff that, that gets us wound up that no one else cares about. And I love that about friendship. I love that about intimacy and friends, you know.
I think what's happened is they've rung up the photographer and they've got the wrong photographer. So they've got a photojournalist who's trying to do an essay on real life in Warrington, good and bad, warts and all, and moments that actually capture Warrington in a different way. They haven't got the guy who does the pretty shots. They've just got the wrong one. And then no one noticed, and they just printed it.
I don't know why there's the Mad Hatter. It's Warrington, and I really apologise for not knowing this, but it says nothing that connects.
And it looks
Lewis
like it's
Harrell
in an empty shopping centre, because there's people miles away in the background. Far too much shadow on this face. It's rather frightening, the
You're going to find out it's not even Warrington.
Yes.
It's some completely unrelated places. Like.
Bratislava.
Yeah,
which had a bizarre affinity with Lewis Carroll.
And I don't want to obsess on this, but if you look on the left-hand picture, and it's a sort
you
of...
You do want to obsess on this, Tom.
I
you
do,
actually
really, yeah.
do.
It's
you
a kind
do,
of market
yeah.
hall, isn't it? So, and,
yes, yeah.
Because they've got the bridal show on, and again, you've got all the details. They seem to put up barriers to stop people going in unless they pay. So there's like five barriers, six barriers, and then you can go through one of them. It's like a sort of mini Glastonbury security.
You can imagine everyone just kind of glued to the railings, looking through, goggling like
yeah.
fish. Like,
or thinking, perhaps I won't bother.
Look at all the spectacular brides.
Yeah.
And what I think is quite...
Spectacular is a big word as well.
There's something bittersweet yeah. about the lady in the foreground who's looking on. You know, she's obviously a slightly older woman. She's probably my age actually now, but I wonder if she's looking on ruefully at the bride spectacular.
She fits into a long aesthetic tradition of a person in the foreground looking into the view on postcards.
This is a David Friedrich thing, isn't it?
Exactly. She's
the Warrington style.
But normally they're wearing red or blue jumpers, and she's wearing a sort of floral housecoat. But
imagine it was like a kind of grizzled Vietnam vet kind of looking over there and smoking a fan.
Yeah. She's
being,
seen it all.
Be like, don't tell me about the bridal spectacular.
I remember.
You weren't there, man. You weren't there.
I know when they were bridal spectaculars. You want spectacular? Not anymore. I've got to put Warrington behind me. So, Peter, thank you for that, Sarah. But, Peter, we've now got something much more traditional in the postcard world now. We've got a lovely... dramatic sort of moonscape. Scottish view, is it?
Yeah.
What have we got?
It's a couple of particularly attractive mountains in the far northwest of Scotland, in Assint in Sutherland. And to be honest, there's no cool story attaching to this postcard. I bought it off eBay, which is probably kind of testament to how the extent to which I think postcards have become a kind of slightly obsolete technology for me and my extremely young and groovy friends.
Sure.
But I love it because it is a proper old postcard. It's got the wavy, wiggly edges. It's got the like kind
decal
of like,
edges, I believe we call them.
Ooh, decal edges. I'll remember that. That's really cool. And it's got like the kind of like Times New Roman style thing at the bottom. And,
yes.
But also it's got that kind of... It's got that kind of old postcard colouring to it that makes everything look like a model. And it's got the badly redone sky in the background that someone's clearly had to go out and...
It's unconvincing, that sky, isn't it?
So it has that kind of... let's not get back into the nostalgia thing, but it does have that kind of, like, the postcard as a kind of a thing you can fetishise as being kind of a past kind of way of looking at things. And, you know, like, it does look like a model. More importantly, this is something that I've had around because you may have heard, but we've been stuck in our houses for the past year and a half, and I am very, very much looking forward to climbing this mountain again.
Oh, really?
This is what I'm holding out for. Yeah, well, the one on the right.
Left or right?
The one on the right. The cool one.
Right.
The one that looks cool. I climbed that about 10 years ago, and... And I had this on, I bought this afterwards off eBay to put on my wall in London to remind me that I didn't just have to survive in London. I could actually drive to Scotland and climb a mountain if I could spare a week and 200 quid.
And when you say climb, I mean, is it like a climb or is it like a very steep walk?
It's a very steep walk. I don't do the stuff with ropes and that because I'm too scared. But I just
like... But it looks like a big walk. I mean,
yeah, it's massive. It's like surprisingly steep, and you get above the clouds. It's cool. But yeah, so I love that. I'm going back next month to climb as many mountains as I possibly can inside a week. And it just reminds me that it's possible to do that. And also that I'm happiest when I'm in the post-glacial landscape.
Right. Why is that?
Because all the other landscapes just aren't really up to snuff, to be honest.
Right.
I like living.
You've got the drama here.
I like living in the ruins of the last glacial maximum and the north of
Scotland.
You're
so nostalgic.
Well, you know, like the thing is, you've just got to have a nostalgia that beats the other nostalgias. Like being nostalgic for the Empire is like nostalgia. That's child's play. I'm nostalgic for when my house was under 2 miles of ice.
Would you camp, or where would you stay?
Well, actually, my mum recently bought herself a little camper van, so I'm going to take that. Oh,
fantastic. Well, as I was saying, I think that is the future. I think everyone's going to want them.
Yeah, I think the Highlands might be pretty mental this year.
I'm looking at this and I'm getting that feeling of yearning that you get when you desperately suddenly want to be somewhere. But you're not just thinking it, you're feeling it. And I'm sort of, fairly unambitious walking, but I've done quite a lot of walking in Scotland and in sort of Derbyshire and lakes and sort of, you know, places not here in the flat south. But, and I miss doing all that. I miss it. And I ought to go and do it again. But I'm with you there, Peter. It's going to be mental now, isn't it? Everyone's going to be rushing for big open spaces now. And we could end up being more cramped than if I just stayed in my house. But I look at postcards like that and think, God, I wish I was there. Yeah, I really, really do.
Can I see a drawing pin hole in this?
You can. Although I can't remember if that was me or not. It might have come with the drawing pin.
Might have inherited it.
Relevant to your interests. It's nice. Someone had this pinned up.
Yeah. No, I see that a lot. And I see sellotape marks, so people have had them pinned above their office desks, particularly.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is. And I think because then it becomes a little really inexpensive gallery that you've got around you. Beautiful things or things that touch you around you in your desk or in your office. I think that's just a really good, simple thing. And we were... In those old days, we were less visually overstimulated. You know, we didn't have a phone with Netflix playing and Instagram and, you know, pictures everywhere. If you wanted a picture on your wall, you had to go to Athena and buy it.
And this is the kind of picture that you end up looking at for a long time and not looking at anything else. It kind of invokes that from you, I think.
Yeah, I like the fact that it is sort of moonscapey and strange. And it's not that comfortable. It doesn't look like a sort of chocolate box landscape. It doesn't matter how long you look at it, it's still strange and odd.
Yeah, I mean, if you've been up to the far northwest of Scotland, it is like it doesn't look like any British landscape that you'd think of as British. It's deeply, deeply odd.
Yeah.
I love it.
Excellent. Well, thank you both.
I just want to crawl all over that mountain.
Well, if you're out of condition, you may find that's exactly what you're doing. thank you both for sharing these pictures. I've said it before, I never know where the cards will send us. I'm delighted you share them with us, with each other, with our listeners at home. Another quick reminder for those of you listening, pictures of all these cards, whether it's the police arresting a young man, whether it's a landscape, whether it's an extraordinary picture of Warrington, these are all going to be on the blog, postcardfromthepast.co.uk. Now, before we let you both off the line and back to your various occupations, I've got one more postcard for you both. So we do normally end on one of these, and sort of by definition, that's what we're going to do now. I would normally pass this last card over to you in the studio, but we're not here together. So if you look at the last card on your bit of paper in front of you, both of you, this is a picture you can see. It's a sort of a townscape taken from a roof. I mean, to the extent it's taken from the roof because you can see bits of the roof. And it's in a sort of middle European town. Mm. You don't recognise the town by any chance, either of you?
Mm, I wouldn't guess. No, I couldn't guess really. I mean, it looks a bit Austrian, maybe.
Well, I think it's Polish. I think it's Torun in Poland.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see there's a dot in the middle of the card, yeah. And that is because, as listeners will be aware, this is a record. It's a postcard that you can play on a gramophone.
Oh that's amazing.
And it's normal size. These were produced in various countries, but the ones in Poland were normal postcards that then they somehow put a layer of film over them and stamped the grooves into it. And unusually, this one, it's a picture of Torun, and I think it was sold in Torun. I don't think the music's anything to do with Torun, but it's a topographical card as opposed to a picture of some flowers or ornaments or something.
Yeah.
And this one was sent in 1967 from Piotr to Liz and Helen, which is probably how it ended up in this country and closer to South London where I am right now. Anyway, young Tom at Water Studios has taken the precaution of making a digital file of this. So if we ask him very nicely, we will be able to hear the sound of this postcard. So I think it's a kind of Polish beat group. This is like the Dave Clark Five. Dave Clark Pięć. What do you think?
That's incredible.
That's a complete Beatles rip-off, isn't it? It's amazing.
Quite a nice tune.
Have you managed to track down who it is?
No, I don't know. I could probably run it by various people, but you'd need to be an expert in 1960s Polish music, I think. Pop music.
I could probably find some.
Yeah, if I played it to the right person, they'd know.
Well, I think, can I do a beautiful link with my blues postcard? There's a lot of blues influence in that tune as well.
Yes, yes.
So, but it's just kind of like, you know, early 60s, you know, Beatles were a blues band basically, weren't they? They were.
Yeah, and, well, and, in part, yeah.
Well, yeah, they were. And yeah, they were, everything's based on the blues, but, oh, the Beatles chord at the end. Yeah, yeah. And what's Polish for Beatles? I don't know.
Well, as in the, yeah, that's a bit of the George Harrison guitar.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a bit scratched, I'm afraid. That's what happens when you send a musical postcard
really?
Through the post.
Yeah. So when you send a record through the post. With
Well, as the town hall of Torun continues to rotate at exactly 33 and a third revolutions per minute, that's it on this time for Podcast from the Past. I'd very much like to thank my first class guests for sharing the postcards from their pasts, Sarah Brand and Peter Mitchell. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Bye for now. You can see more postcards with their messages posted every day on Twitter. Do follow me at Past Postcard. And you can buy the book, Postcard from the Past, by me, Tom Jackson, at Amazon and all good booksellers. And if you're looking for podcast production, check out wardorstudios.co.uk.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.